Hello and welcome to the Odd Job Pod, Action Movie Landfill Edition. I am the host, Terry DeFellin, and the reason I'm the host is because it's an Action Movie Landfill Edition, and Action Movie Landfill means that we whoever chooses the movie to go in the landfill or be rescued from the landfill is chosen as the host, and I have that happy duty. The film that I have chosen, I'll come to in a moment, but first I will introduce my guests. We're all ready to get going. First of all, Graham Sibley. Graham, are you all suited and booted and ready for the chopper?
Oh, yes, I am. Yes, I'm locked and loaded, Terry.
Locked and loaded. You got your flares and your matchbook ready, and your little thing to pump into your chest if you're, your little syringe to pump into your chest just in case you get murdered by gas.
Well, I can't pass a day without doing that because, as you know, I'm of an age now where I'm often murdered by gas.
We are all of an age where gas lingers amongst us like some lingering stalky thing. It's a truly awful. Nobody told us about this. No one warned us. Gary, how about yourself? I figure once we've climbed aboard the island and gone through the myriad catacombs, we might then just like go to the cafeteria, go to visit the gift shop and maybe get the ferry home. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that sounds like an excellent idea. The rock gift shop would be, what would you buy from there? Like a model prison?
Well, I'll tell you. I can tell you about that. I have been to Alcatraz Island, so I know something of that island.
Do you have an Alcatraz mug? Like, you don't have to be mad to be here, but it helps.
No, I do have a. Is it there? Yeah. I'll show it to you guys. I'll hold it up to the camera so the listeners can see. That is a picture of me and my wife with Alcatraz Island in the background.
Excellent. Did you enter in by like going through some form of combustion engine with like unnecessarily swiping sharp things?
I did. And that was, I really wish I hadn't done that. One, because it singed my eyebrows. And two, because there's a perfectly good tourist ferry that leaves from the wharf. I just wish I'd known. This is what happens when you get your tourist information from watching Michael Bay films, listeners. Don't do it, all right? They're for entertainment purposes only.
Have we actually introduced the film yet?
Well, I believe we kind of had. But I think this is the last time we did this, it kind of went. We are, of course, talking about The Rock, the 1996 movie The Rock, not Dwayne Johnson The Rock. A friend of mine, I mentioned this to a colleague who said, declared, I said, what did you do last night? And I said, oh, I watched The Rock. She went, The Rock? I said, yeah, The Rock, the film, The Rock. And she said, that's my favourite film. My favourite film of all time. And I thought, this is fantastic. And she said, I would love for The Rock to do a remake of The Rock.
That's meta.
I could cope with that.
Mm. Meta. Very meta, isn't it?
Yeah. It would be even more if it was a rock opera. So it would be...
Well, I don't think there are any limits. We can put any limits on Dwayne Johnson's talent, frankly. And I think rock operas is well within him. Well within him.
Mm.
Shocked it hasn't happened before. Yes, of course, listeners. Michael Bay's The Rock, 1996, starring, of course, Sean Connery. So there's a degree of additional resonance and narrative going on here. And of course, because we are, when we're not doing stuff like this, we're a James Bond podcast. And of course, Sean Connery played James Bond. You may remember him. He played a few outings earlier on in the franchise, of some consequence. Some people reckon he was the best. Others think it's Roger Moore. Others think it's Pierce Brosnan. But yet Sean Connery, he played John Patrick Mason. And the setup is thus, for those who haven't seen it, Ed Harris stars as Frank Hummel. And he is a general. And he and a band of other Marines, they steal some VX gas, which is incredibly nasty, and some rockets. And they hijack, they take control of Alcatraz Island. They kidnap a whole load of hostages, tourist hostages, and they threaten to kill everyone on San Francisco unless they are given $100 million. $100 million. which doesn't seem like a very large amount. Anyway, the US government aren't prepared to pony up that kind of relatively modest amount, even for 1996, and go to elaborate lengths to stop it, and hijinks ensue. Actually, is there a scenario, chaps, where a completely different film is made? And it's more of a sort of like a detective film, in which Nicolas Cage, who is also in this film, and is charged with going after Hummel and his team once they've been allowed off the island with the money. Because surely the play here is to go, do you know what? This is incredibly dangerous. Let's wire them the cash, have lots and lots of cameras pointed at them, and then hunt these guys down later. Is that a better film, I wonder, or a different film? Graham, what do you think?
Well, that's calling to question is to whether or not you need to send in the Navy SEALs anyway. If you're just going to call their bluff, then why bother sending anyone on the island anyway? Yeah,
that's what I thought.
If you're just going to blow them all up, why bother? It's a plan that's got a very, very minimal chance of succeeding. And if you're relying on someone who was on the island 30 years ago but since has been avoiding gang rape in the showers, then you would think that maybe he's not the most reliable scout to take you into a hostile environment. I think that the thing about The Rock, though, is like many action films and like many Bond films, maybe it's not worth inspecting too closely, which I know, which means that we are going to have problems talking about it for the next hour or so. But I think there are lots of ways that this story could have gone on. And I think really for Jerry Bruckheimer's purposes and Don Simpson's purposes, I think it really, really did. It had a remit and I think it succeeded in following it, I think.
Yeah, Gary, it's a tremendous setup, actually. It is somewhat, who's going to be churlish enough to look at that and say, well, that's a bit of a stupid idea for a film? I mean, come on. It's like, buy the ticket and enjoy yourself. But it is a cracking setup, actually. Because, I mean, I love the opening sequence of the movie. I think I think it's quite moving. The Americans, Hollywood's really good at doing sort of like, the dignity of the US military really, really well. Especially if there's, dress uniforms, lots of rain, lots of, mournfulness, sadness, dignity, And I thought that those opening stanza of the film where Harris is visiting his late wife's grave, and then they go about the business of stealing the gas, I think that sets the film up really, really well.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a film that plot-wise, realistically, is just there to shoehorn in an assault on Alcatraz with two leads. And I think in probably lesser hands, it could have ended up quite, quite badly. Or just like, a Steven Seagal knockoff. Quite easily, but I think there's a lot that has to be given credit, even though the plot is kind of ridiculous. It moves along at such a great pace, and also I think the casting of Ed Harris and the role that they've got him in is probably one of the key points within the film. Like there's a lot that they get right within here, but having Ed Harris, who is a really good substantial actor, who can he's one of those kind of interesting actors, because he's not, I wouldn't say he's necessarily distinctive, but he's somebody that means he can kind of morph quite easily into any type of character. So when you've got him here is this kind of, it'd be very easy for him to go into mad general mode. There's the Stephen Berkoff template from Octopussy would be an incredibly easy route to follow. And, there's nothing wrong with that. The mad general is a wonderful trope that goes throughout many, many movies. But there's something about how that's kind of handled. And it adds a kind of another layer of intrigue into it, because sometimes with a villain like that, you can get very kind of, either you kind of go just scenery chewing, or they're just really badly written. And in the wrong actor's hands, it can also kind of flop a bit. But you can, like, even though they're just, I was watching and going, you know what? I think there might be better ways to try and request compensation for veterans' families than taking 81 prisoners hostage on a former prison colony just off San Francisco whilst taking some rockets armed with deadly nerve gas. And threatened fire there for, yes, the paltry sum of $100 million. I kind of feel that there might be better ways to achieve your aim in there. Not entirely sure, but I think, you know, he could have potentially looked at other options. But actually, as the character, he just buys into it and he's completely convincing. And actually, there's something quite sad about his kind of demise within the film, because he does carry an awful lot of it. And there's some interesting kind of tensions in there. That kind of ending of where he's kind of realizes what he's done. It's like, maybe you could have had to think about that a little bit earlier before it descended completely into chaos. But there's an element of, say, something about the Bridge on the River Kwai, about Guinness's character, who completely believes he's right until he suddenly realizes how badly, badly wrong he's been all the way throughout. So, yeah, I mean, we obviously came in to talk about many things, which is, you know, the action, the Connery and everything. But depth isn't necessarily something you get from many Michael Bay movies, I would probably argue. But this is one bit where you do get quite a bit of depth. And I think it makes the film much better for it.
Yeah, I agree, Graham. Ed Harris, I think, is one of the key components as to why this film works, actually. His and indeed the portrayal of Frank Hamill. I think that this is clearly a man, again going back to a great military man, a huge amount of dignity, a man who has a strict code of honor, who has now stepped outside of that because he's desperate. Now, I would submit to you that this is a much more interesting film than, or a much more commercially viable film than, a film about a retired general who decides to start, you know, a mass movement, a political movement, to persuade, you know, the Pentagon and Congress to compensate victims of the families of victims of black ops operations. That is a film that is probably worth watching, but I don't think it necessarily fills the remit of The Rock. But I think that Harris is key to the authenticity and the sincerity of the plot. And like, we all know this is kind of ridiculous, but we're going with it, so stay with us. And he plays a big role in that.
Yeah, he does. He plays a very believable villain, which is almost unheard of in action films, when, you know, you want your villains to be over the top. Contrast and compare Alan Rickman's performance in Die Hard. You know, there is a lot of that here, but plays completely outlandishly, and he's a very, very flamboyant villain. It doesn't matter who he kills. Whereas Ed Harris's Hummel character is now this is someone with depth. This is someone with pain, and this is someone who knows how to talk to people as well, and which also undermines the plot a bit, because you don't almost get swept up in his megalomania and his bizarre ideas, because you can think, well, why is someone so measured doing this frankly stupid thing? So it is. Ed Harris is in his pomp in the mid to late 90s, isn't he? This is between Apollo 13 and Truman Show, isn't it? Which I guess, I mean, he will probably point towards serious roles that he did with great aplomb, but most people know him for those three films, I would guess. Anyway, it was certainly the ones where I was going to the cinema quite often. So these were great films, and three very different characters he played in each one of them, and he brought everything to those roles. But as a character, Hummel is great, but of course there are things in there. I mean, like, you come to see a Michael Bay action film, you don't expect the leading characters to be like having a philosophical debate about things or quoting Oscar Wilde. It's quite nice, but it's these are things that the plot gets away with and actually helps flesh it out. It also brings it open a bit more. This isn't just like lots and lots of explosions and lots of gunfire. There is some heart to this film. It is a lot of explosions and a lot of gunfire, but there is some heart filling in the gaps in between.
There's a wonderful, like, and I think it's a kind of bit of wonderful bit of kind of twist into the plot, which, again, is really kind of interestingly and artfully handled. And I've been trying to think of other films that do this in a similar way, because normally it's kind of like, oh, surprise, this is the bad guy. But in this one, there's kind of a bit of a surprise. It's not quite what you think it is. And it's that bit where Sean Connery just goes, yeah, he won't fire them. I've looked into his eyes. And it's just delivered with conviction. And I'd not kind of picked up on it before, but I suddenly went, that's a bit of a throw, because you've kind of brought into it and that he's ruthless and will do it absolutely. And then you suddenly you're like, hang on, that really starts to change dynamic and sets it up for that final coda of the film with the kind of all the various climaxes in there. But again, it's a really interesting way of taking an action film, of essentially putting the villain into a place where he's like, oh, hang on, what are we dealing with here?
Yeah, and that's that for me, that's the most Bond thing in the whole thing. When he's walking down there and said, I've looked him in the eye, I know he's not going to do it. He's walking away from it like he is in that moment Bond. And there's quite a few bits in there where you can see the scriptwriters have sailed as close as they can to making him Bond without making him Bond. They specifically correct Ed Harris for calling him a sailor. Just to say, nope, come on, we're coming back here. We're not, yeah, okay. Even down to he delivers a line, an exact line from Diamonds Are Forever. Did you spot it?
Yeah, of course you are.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, yeah, of course you are.
Named after your father, no doubt. I wish he would have completed that. So there is that thing. But yeah, that moment, yeah, when he said, I looked in the eyes and knew it. It's a sort of thing that in most action film, that is made as played as a machismo moment. But this wasn't. This was just something, two guys having a chat and then reading it, which is what, you know, spies have got to do all the time. They've got to be able to read someone, assess them, and know exactly what they're going to do. And yeah, that was, yeah, you're right, Gary, for picking that one out. That was one of my favorite points, that one.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to applaud the mental fortitude of a man who spent 30 years in prison suddenly being sharp as a tack and able to come out and handle
well, I think if you've been in a maximum security, I think your judge of character probably is quite honed by then.
Absolutely. The confrontation between Hummel and Mason is one of the highlights of the film. And again, it felt very, very Bondy. And but you know, we're obviously, the audience is treated to two colossal actors spending a brief moment of time in this moment, and the dialogue is great, and the chemistry between them is just fantastic. And again, is really, really good film. There's a thinking about it, this film, a lot of this film is about like honor and the code of the soldier or the code of the serviceman and that sort of like unspoken bond between them, which I don't know whether or not that's just stuff for movies or whether there's any truth of that, not being a military man. But it really it makes for some fantastic viewing and entertaining. It really, as you say, Graeme, just puts the soul into the film. And one of the reasons why the film works is because the film's got a soul. And this is the key to action movies. Action movies have to have this, otherwise they're just a bunch of explosions. And they're not actually that exciting. Shall we reflect a little bit more on John Mason, since we are here with him? Let's talk about the character John Mason. Former SAS, he's stolen a microfilm on behalf of the British government. The British government had disavowed him, and then, you know, the US government have locked him up in jail, and that guy from the West Wing is the guy who's put him there and is clearly his nemesis. I mean, do you think, I didn't when I was researching this, I'm not sure I saw anything where it was suggested that Michael Bay or John Frankenheimer were thinking about James Bond when they were putting this film together. And I'm sure they wouldn't publicly say that they were, given how notoriously litigious Eon's lawyers can be. but I mean, they must have at times thought to myself, you know, this is a great sort of like James Bond retirement story, isn't it?
I've got as part of my research, I spent 20 minutes last night watching YouTube of Pentex's deep dive into why he believes that John Mason is James Bond, which was actually very entertaining, makes his case quite well. Although I'd argue there's one big thing that he overlooked in that it seems that John Mason met the one-night stand who became the mother of his child at a Led Zeppelin concert. And we all know that Bond does not listen to the Beatles without earmuffs. So I'm not entirely sure that particular detail holds up. But there's other things that make it very, very compelling. I've kind of been mulling over this, and I wonder if, because Jerry Bruckheimer's come out and explicitly said no, that we never even crossed our mind at all in there. Now, that might be the case with Bruckheimer, but I have a suspicion that there's some people within there, the production unit, who probably had a bit more fun and an inkling within here. And it's probably a little bit, I wonder how much it is chicken and egg within there, in that you've got this character of John Mason who could be Bond, could not be Bond, but, you know, has these Bondish elements and would be kind of fair enough in there. And it's almost inevitable that those who kind of put the script together and fleshed out the details, and probably some people have credited people on the rewrites, have kind of gone, yeah, you know, we'll make him a little bit Bondy. And then you've got the casting of Connery. And I wonder how much both kind of started to inform each other, because I'm not entirely sure at what stage Connery was signed on to the project and what stage of script development was at. But I do wonder if there's some people kind of behind the scenes who've gone, we're going to have a bit of fun with that, because, you know, we are a bunch of Bond nerds. There's going to be quite a few based around Hollywood. I wonder if there's a few people going, having a bit of fun. Now, I'm not necessarily sure whether I totally buy into it. Although, as I say, the argument I saw last night was incredibly well researched. And, you know, it depends what you want. And I can completely get with it as well. I think there's been some people, there was some really, really strong knowledge of Bond and Bond lore, whether it's just they're playing to Connery or whether they are really taking it and running with it, I'm not entirely sure. I would buy that Bruckheimer wasn't necessarily thinking about that, because I don't think Bruckheimer's probably that kind of guy. So I kind of, if I can kind of sit firmly on the fence, I'm a bit 50-50 onto it. I think there's a lot of knowing in there, but I'm not quite sure how much is deliberate and how much is kind of a little bit of just the writers having fun with what they've got.
Well, Well, it does come out the same summer as GoldenEye, doesn't it? So you may as well piggyback on quite a bit of the Bond hype that's going out there.
That's probably maybe where a lot of the association comes from. Speaking of the writers, of course, Connery always brought along, well, not always, but frequently brought along Dick Clement and Ian Le Frenay to help him with his dialogue, who worked on Never Say Never Again and other things. So there's maybe a little bit of lineage going on there. And apparently Tarantino and Aaron Sorkin are uncredited script doctors on this. And I wouldn't be at all surprised maybe if Tarantino maybe just was having a little bit of fun, but who knows what parts of dialogue that he did. It makes a big, there's so many people involved in making these kind of movies.
Well, you know, if you want some prison dialogue, then Dick Clement and Ian Le Frenay are probably the best guys to bring in. I mean, they came up with one of the best prison series ever, didn't they? Porridge.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So for those who don't know, international listeners, Porridge was a sitcom from the 1970s here in the UK about a prison life, starring Ronnie Barker and Richard Beckinsale. And it's a classic, and it still is repeated today. It's not been cancelled, which is, you know, and for a 70s sitcom, that's pretty good going. I mean, while we're talking, did you want to come in, Gary? You had your hand raised.
I was going to say, I mean, I think like the details that are in there are clearly going to be a nod to Bond. There's quite a few, like right down to, again, I refuse to believe that the dialogue line that Graham's kind of highlighted, of course you are, is accidental. And also the fact that, you know, John Mason demands a suite in a 5-star hotel and a suit. You know, those are entirely Bond elements. And again, they're not necessarily details that need to be in there. Like, you could just easily make him a former British Secret Service or any kind of Secret Service guy who'd been locked up for a bit and can kick ass. And that's all very believable. But the level of kind of little extra details, touches it's in there, are so Bondian that, yeah, somebody's having fun within there. What level of fun? Not quite sure whether how deep they've gone, but there's definitely somebody who's been fiddling around with the scripts and, you know, production and going, yeah, let's just throw a few more nods and winks into Bond into here.
Fair enough. Let's draw a line under the idea that this might be an unofficial James Bond film. We all know that the James Bond retirement film is going to be Graham's idea, which is that James Bond is finally released from a North Korean prison all of those years, 20-odd years later, and the whole of the second half of the whole of Die Another Day was just some scorpion poison-infested hallucination, which is the film that I think we all very badly need to see, very badly need to see. Barbara, if you're listening, well, see Graham about it. It's his idea, not mine.
Can I also make one last Bond point? And this isn't a John Mason one.
This is the James Bond podcast. So, yes.
Good. I'm glad you allowed me that into that. No, you can't talk Bond on a Bond podcast. Probably because, you know, I think I can't remember the last time I'd seen The Rock. I've seen it quite a few times. I hadn't seen it for quite a few years. I was suddenly, as the ending, I suddenly went, holy crap, the ending is incredibly similar to No Time to Die, except that Nicolas Cage survives and Daniel Craig doesn't. And I completely forgotten the ending, and I don't think I've seen this since I'd seen No Time to Die. And I just went, wow, this is almost feels like it's a type. I have no idea if, again, like we've talked so much about how the Bond movies are so like intertwined with other movies and incestuous, but that was something that I just went, I'm just watching the final bit, albeit done by Michael Bay, rather than slightly more high concept from Cary Fukuyama in there. But it's almost an identical ending. Quite bizarre.
Yeah, guy on top of a lump of concrete with Hans Zimmer stirring in the background. Easily done, Gary.
I mean, what a coincidence. I mean, now you're talking coincidences. That's one I'd never thought that No Time to Die is throwing back to The Rock. But now I've seen it, I can't unsee it.
Well, we're all throwing back to The Rock sooner or later. Let's talk about The Rock a little bit. I'd like to talk about the prisoners that are captured, because that's... I feel like there might be some stuff on the cutting room floor here with this, guys. I don't know if you agree with me, but that, for all the world, looked like there was a subplot being set up amongst the prisoners, because in the initial stages you had the warden, Warden Jerry is his name, and it all looked like he was being set up to be a character. And there looked like there was some back and forth and some, you know, what's going on here. And it just felt like there were some characters developing here amongst the hostages. And then really, apart from poor Larry, who almost got his brains blown out, they kind of became super peripheral. I don't know whether or not you got any views on that. Do you think that maybe that's an opportunity missed, or do you think maybe they were right to just go, nah, let's crack on with the action?
I think they're just hoping that you forget about it. I mean, yeah, there is that lovely scene in there with the with about the gun. I think it's Ranger Bob, isn't it? Is that his name?
Ranger Bob. Thank you.
And he's in the prison cell with the woman on there, and she said, "You don't have a gun." And he's like, "I've got a gun. I should have brought mine." Which is a nice bit of play. And you say, "Well, is she coming back? We've been introduced to her. It'd be nice if we were." But also you get that little hint that he's not completely deranged, because he sends all the kids back on the boat somehow. I don't know how that actually happens, but yeah. There are lots of things to do with that you don't really see, because they get in the way of the action. And I suppose if you wanted to make it a 3-hour film, if this was Michael Mann's Rock, then maybe you would have a bit of that going in there. That's going to haunt my dreams, isn't it?
From Michael Mann's Heat to Michael Mann's Rock, listeners, we made that journey.
Maybe so. I don't know. I think the hostages have to be there because they can't just blow up the island. They can't just blow up the island because there's 81 people there. So they have to be there. But whether or not you could use them, I don't know. Maybe they've already got one civilian there. They've already got Nicolas Cage. He's there to be the civilian type character there anyway. So he's got the loved one at home. You don't really need to lay it on. Everyone's got loved ones there. They're a bit like the party goes in Die Hard, I suppose, aren't they, really? They're just roomy, aren't they?
Yeah. You mentioned Nicolas Cage there, and we're 31 minutes into this podcast, and we've not spoken about Stanley Goodspeed at all. And I think that's overdue. There's no particular reason for that. It's just the way the conversation has gone. Nick Cage, everyone in this film is in the absolute peak of their powers, which is why another reason why this film just works so well is that everyone's really on it. This is arguably peak Cage. I know he's going through a bit of a renaissance now. He's gone into post-action hero. And he is an actor of substance as well. Always has been. Always been a good actor. Too good for action films, but you know, he's very good at them, and they pay lots and lots of money. And this is the man who gave us Con Air, and for that we should always be grateful. But I think, Graham, this is, you know, if you're looking, if you watch one Nicolas Cage action film, watch Con Air. But if you watch two, watch The Rock.
Yeah, definitely. Con Air first, because it's miles away. It's the best action film ever made. We've already agreed that. Then you get The Rock. And the thing is as well, is that Con Air is made because of The Rock, isn't it? This one is got so much stuff going on in there. And there is a very brief period where it looks in on itself and realizes how ridiculous it is. The scene when Cage is on the floor in there, pretty much explaining the plot of this, like, you know, this whole weak plot of the fact that they've managed to weaponize toxic masculinity and they're going to rain it down on San Francisco. It's basically that, isn't it? He's going over this thing there, and that's what pretty much the whole premise of Con Air is looking at how ridiculous action movies actually are. So he brings something that you don't normally expect in action movies of this time, and I think he wasn't really an action movie guy before this.
I don't think so.
It was coming through like weird indie stuff and like, but in the 90s he was making stuff, really, really varied stuff, wasn't he? So I think he's brilliant in it, and he works so well. I've seen lots of casting things about the fact that Arnold Schwarzenegger was meant to be in this, but it's not clear as to what role he was meant to be. Some say he was meant to be the Goodspeed character. Some say he was the Mason character. But his own recollections is that the script was all over the place when he got it, and there was loads of pencil drawings and everything like that. He couldn't make head or tail of it. Took one look at it and thought, no, I'll have something that's typed up, please. And so, he turned it down, like he turned down Face Off as well, another Nick Cage action movie that came after. But apparently that was meant to be, Face Off was meant to be like, you know, like De Niro and Pacino's Heat. Face Off was meant to be Schwarzenegger and Stallone in the same film. So yes, before The Expendables, that was meant to be the one. That one came after, but he ended up doing that with John Travolta. I know. Maybe that will be in the landfill. Who knows? What's not to love? I mean, Nicolas Cage brings something special to an action movie, and every action movie I've seen him in is brilliant, without exception.
There's a level of kind of, there's something about Cage because he's such a magnetic screen presence, he has that really fine line, which is so hard. Not many actors can do it. Pacino can do it as well, between the over the top and the actual putting depth and humanity into the characters. And I think this was probably almost immediately after leaving Las Vegas, which got an Oscar for. So, you know, yeah, big, big shift within here. And Cage is certainly somebody as well. If you let him, he will kind of can dominate and lead movies, which he did in Con Air. This one's quite an interesting one because he's playing alongside Connery. And I think Connery has top billing in this one, maybe. I can't remember. But there's certainly kind of equals within there. And you can kind of, I mean, the chemistry between Connery and Cage is great, but you can also kind of really get a sense that Cage is willing to let Connery be Connery. And Connery's willing to let Cage be Cage. And when you've got two actors who are kind of like, yeah, I like what you're doing and I'm going to give you space around here, and their characters are so totally different, and, you know, it's that classic odd couple coming together, it just works. But it's really, you know, everything onto it works slightly differently. You can definitely feel that sometimes, you know, Nicolas Cage can run away with it a bit. In Con Air, he totally leads and carries the whole movie. Here, he definitely looks like he's much more happier to let Connery do his thing. And I kind of got the sense as well, when I was reading an anecdote, I think from Cage, that, you know, offset, he used to just kind of sit and take tips from Connery, and they chat and they drink whiskey together. So I think you can kind of almost see that respect coming through for his co-star in here. And again, it's one of those bits that really kind of makes the movie, because the chemistry between the two of them is just fun. It's really, really fun watching two very different actors from different generations and different areas come together, and they're not an obvious pairing, but something about it just really works.
Yeah, it's a great buddy movie in that respect, isn't it? I think Cage is brilliant. I think that the character of Stanley Goodspeed is an interesting one. I thought it was and it's a really good idea of getting a nerd or a geek to go in there. You know, a massive Beatles fan, definitely sort of like, you know, a gamer adjacent, probably would have been a massive sort of like Marvel fan, maybe, if this movie had been made about 20 years later. No, and yeah, the guy who, you know, who fucks the prom queen, and, you know, and one of life's winners, and yet still sort of like very, very geeky and very, very clever, and of course classically educated. And I think that's one of the things the two characters, or that Goodspeed was in a position to give some trust to Mason, because he recognized that there was some depth to him because of his cultural references. And I really like that. I wonder, as a slight aside, the character of Paxton, who I think is a really, really interesting supporting character, particularly in those early stages, when helping Goodspeed to come to terms with the fact that he's going to have to go on this mission. I really, really liked that moment. I thought he was a really interesting character. I wonder if actually that was Arnie's character rewritten, and that maybe in another world that would have been, Paxton would have been Arnie's character, and it would have been a big Arnie Connery Harris face-off, and that might have been quite an interesting film to watch. I think I prefer this one. I think you're right. I like Cage's indiness that he still had there going, and he brought that to it. And yeah, indeed, we wouldn't have had Con Air without him. So I think it's an absolute triumph there. some of the supporting characters in this film, I just mentioned Paxton earlier, I think was a terrific William Forsythe, the actor. And I mentioned, of course, the West Wing guy, John Spencer, who I think and just generally speaking, there's a fantastic supporting line up there of a really, really good characters. Tony Todd, who plays Captain Darrow, who's the one of the two slightly unhinged mercenary soldiers who is one of the first to unravel when it looks like the plot's going. Tony Todd, who sadly left us in November. And if you're a Star Trek fan, you know Tony Todd. He's one of the great character actors of the TV scene, as a much loved actor. But it's the ensemble, particularly amongst the hostage takers, amongst Hummel's crew, that I think also make that movie, that the tension between them as it starts to develop as the film goes on is really, really well paced.
Yeah, I mean, you could say a bunch of character actors and it all works out well, but they really are. I mean, you've got people like John C. McGinley. I don't know if he was in much at the time, but he's done a lot of TV work since. You've got David Morse, who I think most people might recognise from 12 Monkeys. That's who I refer to. Oh, it's your fella from 12 Monkeys. the way that it's played, it's not always your sort of like really high end testosterone fuel thing. There is actual genuine tension there. That standoff at the end, there is as much tension as you want. And when the realization that they're not soldiers anymore, they're mercenaries, and they operate on a different set of rules now. And that's interesting, because almost as if the characters there are working out, which you can tell anyway as an observer, you wouldn't be doing this unless you were soldiers. And this whole thing that he clings to, the fact that he's like a revolutionary soldier from the 18th century, and that just crumbles into dust, because at the end of the day, he's just someone who's holding a nation to ransom, isn't he?
There's two great speeches, isn't there? There's the one, the pompous one, by Hummel, and where he's talking about Washington and Jefferson, having the arrogance to compare himself to those two, which does set him up as a villain, because it's a clearly conceited, arseholish thing to say. It's a ridiculous thing to say. And then towards the end, there's a much shorter one by Darrow, by Tony Todd, and there's just like, the moment we stole that gas, we became mercenaries, and mercenaries get paid. And that was just like, Harris's reaction is absolutely spot on. The tension in there, the realization of what's going on, it really lends to the film, doesn't it, Gary?
It does. It's interesting as well that because you've got, essentially, it's an excuse clearly for Tarantino to just rerun Reservoir Dogs at that point, because you have got that, you know, the guns pointed onto each other. Just a one quick tangent as well. I'm not a massive fan of Michael Bay movies overall, but I was really surprised in this one just how many throws to different types of cinema and like film classics you've got within here, because obviously you've got the nods to Bond, you've got the Reservoir Dogs thing, which is probably just Tarantino having a bit of fun, you also got like what I'd say is a reference to Bullet as well, you know, the San Francisco car chase, and I'm like, again, I didn't come to The Rock expecting to see bits of homage and love of other action cinema, but you can tell how much love has gone into it, because there are a lot of different references to other classic movies that are in there. And yeah, it also comes to, and I think you can kind of tell, everybody who's working on this knows their points of reference. They know what they're trying to do. And we've talked about this a lot with Bond films as well. If the film knows what it's trying to do, it doesn't matter how ridiculous it is, and it sticks to it with conviction, you've got a really good film in there. And it does this. And it does this with a lot of love and respect for everything that's come before it. This is a film that knows genre perfectly. It knows how to take every single bit. You know, you talk about that tension and the mercenary element in there, you know, classic, again, another kind of classic trope from it, the Mad General that comes in. they're packing in so many different elements into here. Again, you kind of wonder where those influences from. Tarantino might be a relatively obvious one, although I know he tends to go a bit more obscure, but there's a lot of knowing what they're playing with. And sometimes that can just end up being a bit horrifically self-smug and referential. I'm sure there's other films that have kind of done that, and I can't think of any off the top of my head, but when they're kind of trying to, well, probably Marvel to an extent, and actually some of the Bonds, probably Spectre does that a little bit too badly, where it tries to kind of throw back. But this is a film that knows where it sits, it knows what its framed reference is, and it's having fun with it. And it's also, I'd say, not just done to entertainment. There's a lot of love and craft that's gone into this. And again, it comes out, the more you watch it, I wouldn't say action films necessarily have richness and depth, but I can't remember how many times I've watched The Rock, and watching it again, first time in quite a few years, I went, yeah, there's a lot more depth to this than necessarily I think I would have remembered, picked up for the first time. It's a film that actually gives you much more texture on repeated watches, which is, I don't think you can really say about many other Michael Bay films. I mean, I don't know. I might have offended Graham, who's a massive Transformers fan, but he hasn't.
Graham, do you want to share your love of Transformers here? Or the challenge is with you.
I think I've only ever seen one Transformers film, and that was the first one, and I don't think I watched it more than once. So I'm afraid that's a huge section of the Michael Bay canon that is lost to me, I'm afraid. but yeah, I mean, he does a great job on this one. He does pack a lot in here. But I think that's one of the things about this film is that it's if this was a video game, and it wasn't, not to my knowledge anyway. I'm sure it has been there's lots of elements of it that have been used, I'm sure, in video games. But if you put yourself in the mind of this is pretty much a sandbox one. You want to explore more. You want to explore more of the island. You want to look at the gift shop. The gift shop is a sublight level, isn't it, that we didn't use. I mean, I'm sure that you've got some kind of cheat code to get yourself in there, but there is like the ridiculous sort of like going underneath the boiler thing. What the hell is the boiler doing on in a disused prison? Doesn't matter. This is exactly the same scene. Exactly the same scene was in Galaxy Quest, and they pointed out the ridiculousness of it. why is this thing here? What is the purpose of this thing? And here it is. Yes, this is very ordinary. This is the back door into the way into this prison. But it's all done, and that's part of the craft. Part of the craft is to introduce ridiculous things like that and to make them believable and just you know, you're eating popcorn. What more do you care? Look, let's see if he can roll his way through these flames and things that are flying around in different directions.
I was just thinking, how awesome would this have been if they created it as an Easter egg in GoldenEye N64?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that would have been amazing. That would have been truly amazing. I now feel sad that didn't happen. I know. I feel that we need to demand that this game is
someone has probably done a rock mod on it. So yes.
Yeah. Probably true. There's a touch of Indiana Jones, the Temple of Doom going on there as well, if you like. As
oh,
well.
God, yes.
But of course, you get away with it because famously, Alcatraz Island has served many purposes down the years. It's best known for being a prison, but of course, it was a fort beforehand and does something. And that then allows the audience to believe that there are other things, other areas, yeah, indeed, and you know, phantom boilers that never die, you know, it's like, you know, that allow you that moment. And all you need, that's the beauty of these movies, all you need is just a slightest encouragement to buy into it, and you're there, you know. It just has to be done right, you know. You do have to get this right, and that's why there are so many bad films. That's why we have an action movie landfill, because there's so many really bad films in this. There's a couple of characters I just wanted to just like talk about. One very briefly, and another with a little bit more time. I can't remember the character's name, but there's that snotty-nosed 30-year-old White House guy who's in the Pentagon briefing room at the very beginning, when Harris is laying down his demands. We never see this guy again, and this is good because he's no good, and we wouldn't. But I thought that it was interesting that they introduced that guy. And much like the lady in the and Ranger Bob, you know, I just think you set up this character and yet we never see him again. And then there's Carla, who we do obviously see a good deal more of, but there are large parts of the film where she is really just sort of like sitting there waiting. And I do appreciate that that is really all she has to do. But it feels as though there could have been some character moments with Carla that I reckon might well have been filmed, but they've just decided to just leave that aside to just focus on the action. Are you with me on that? And that is that in Carla's case, is that a negative point, I think, for the film or not? I don't know. What do you think, guys? Graham, what do you think?
I think that they paint themselves into a corner with her because there's not a lot she can actually do. All she's got to do is be concerned and actually be a threat. She's actually like a threat of damage to Nick Cage's character because she's just in San Francisco. So that's the whole point. The whole point is he wants her out of San Francisco, but she's in San Francisco. So So you have to keep looking at her to think, oh, look, this extremely beautiful woman is about to get killed and she's carrying a baby. And, oh, no, it's all horrible and pain. This is what Nick Cage is fighting for. So I suppose that's it. So, yes, a longer film with breathing space. Again, Michael Mann's Rock has probably got a whole subplot with Carla and maybe she talks to another woman for 5 minutes about something that isn't Nicolas Cage, and then it passes the Bechdel test, and then we've got a completely different film.
Maybe, Gary, she talks to Mason's daughter, who, again, I mean, that makes a lot more sense, that whole thing. That was very, very nice because I think it established the humanity of the character as well. And I don't think that we expected to see more from her, but I thought that was a quite nice, a nice little rejoinder just to put in there and just establish a bit of tone and context and humanity to the character.
Yeah, again, this is what makes me think that the makers of No Time to Die spent time watching The Rock when they were coming up with plot inspiration. But it is a nice unexpected touch that comes in here. Obviously, it's a very, very Bond thing to do. I'm amazed that he doesn't have many more illegitimate children floating throughout the world. But it's also a type of thing that kind of works with the character. But yeah, adds a little bit of grounding and humanity into the John Mason character as well. And you've got that lovely bit where, this again is one of my favourite moments, which is just a lovely bit of kind of acting where, the police arrive to pick back up Mason again. And Stanley Goodwin takes steps in and basically goes, no, he's with us. He's on a mission. And it just, diffuses things a little bit. And it kind of is those little understated touches of humanity, which, to be honest, you can kind of quite easily miss. The supporting cast and characters I wonder if misdirection. Some of them I just wonder if they hit the cutting room floor. Some I just wonder if it's just a case that, you've got some good writers in there. Like, you talk about the snot-nosed chief of staff. That feels very Aaron Sorkin in there. And you just wonder if you've got the quality of writers who've just chucked in a bit of their own thing. Producers and Brock have gone, it doesn't really matter. People are here to watch, explosions on Alcatraz. Great, we've got some nice written stuff into here. It doesn't. And again, it's kind of, to a certain extent, I don't have a problem with it. And again, There's plenty of films that I think we've discussed on this podcast where you can definitely, you feel a slightly problematic towards women. I feel, and their representation and the lack of screen time. I think this one is one that nothing doesn't make sense within there. You can kind of understand where it's coming from. And that's, again, with all the minor characters that are in there. There's enough. It's actually unusual, probably, for an action film to have so much kind of rounding on. But when I say rounding, they're not just completely kind of one-dimensional people in almost every single character within there. There's a bit which you go, yeah, different director might have developed it, but clearly they're not massively interested in that. They've still written them well enough, and everything in there is kind of believable. And you don't, it just rattles through. And you're like, okay, another character that comes in. And actually, they can kind of be very similar to, you know, if this was a longer form TV series, then, you know, they'd probably got a bit more time, but then it'd come in and come out a bit. Whereas here, it's just like, you know, we haven't got time. Let's just get back to the explosions. And, yeah, I think I like the pacing on this one. Some films, you kind of like, yeah, I'd love to expand that out a little bit more. But, yeah, just because Michael Bay's rock isn't as long as Michael Mann's rock doesn't necessarily mean that it's problematic.
I think a lot of the characters, the chief of staff's name is Hayden Sinclair, played by a guy called David Marshall Grant. His character really is just a nod to a lot of similar characters that were in a lot of TV shows and films from the 1990s. There's a lot of deep state stuff in this, lots of nods to it. I mean, especially like, you know, the final scene, you'll never guess who killed JFK. So that JFK was very, very big in the 90s, wasn't it? And the whole sort of, hey, here's another one. Oliver Stone's The Rock. Now, think about that one. Think about that. What would that be like?
Think about it.
Yeah.
Think about it.
Yeah.
You have to do your own research on that one.
Yes, you do. You do. So there is a lot of that. Also, 24 as well. I suppose there's elements of the stuff in there that is going on. All these cultural touchstones that they're using here, and the shorthands that just say, look, just fill in the rest of your gaps here. You know, this is what these guys are for. You don't need us to do this, but this is what The Rock has. This is the depth of The Rock. This is probably what you get when you got so many people involved in writing on it. They're going to enter bits of characters in there that will have a backstory, will have something that you can think of. And yeah, usually there are souls, but you know, we've got things there that we can think about. Yes, here's an arsehole, and I know this because X, Y, or Z. So yes.
Yeah, and misinformation and conspiracy theories, of course, are now passed well and truly into the political mainstream now. Everyone, you know, everyone believes everything, don't they? But yeah, the lovely 90s tropes, the assassination of JFK was a massive obsession of a conspiracy theory, as indeed was the Roswell, which of course, and Spencer, you know, just speaks about those as though they were things that actually happened, which is supposed to take us out of the universe, out of our universe, into their universe. But actually, I don't think that's what happened at all.
Well, yeah, and it doesn't happen at all. And of course, the thing is that it turns in on itself because The Rock became part of a conspiracy, didn't it? It actually be the.
Well, yes.
Yeah,
it did. Yeah, indeed. Yes. When the British Secret Service were utilizing a source within Iraq on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, one of the reports that came back was that the gas that Saddam Hussein had was based upon the same configuration that was in The Rock. And the manner in which the gas is stored is completely fictionalized. It's dramatized. It's to make it much more fun and more exciting towards the end. It's got nothing to do with how you actually store nerve gas whatsoever. And a chemistry undergraduate would have been able to have told you this, but it was enough to fool the Secret Service, and it was enough of a pretext to allow Britain to participate in the war in the Gulf with horrific consequences, it should be said. But yes, that is an unfortunate legacy of the film, which is not the film's fault, of course.
Of course not. No.
and not a reason for disliking the film or holding against it. If I could just quickly go back to that scene in the Palace of Fine Arts between Jade and John Patrick Mason, I just loved Connery's restraint when he's talking to his daughter for the first time, you know, in 30 years. And I just loved the fact that, you know, he had previously destroyed half of Russia Hill and one extremely expensive heritage cable car in order to get just for that one, this brief few moments to be able to see her. I thought that was brilliant. And we talk about the heart of this movie, and this is part of the heart of this movie. And there's why we like this movie, and we buy into what they do because we like the characters. We identify with the characters. But I also love the fact that just as that exchange was coming to an end, they cut to Nick to Goodspeed, who is listening to all of this. And his whole view on Mason is completely and utterly changed. And he takes a totally different view. And his initial, you know, trust has been completely void. He can identify with this guy, and of course, being a man who's about to be a father himself, and none of that, no expositionary dialogue required. All of that firmly understood in the minds of the audience. We all know exactly where everyone's character motivations are. Really, really bloody good filmmaking. Michael Bay is actually kind of wasted on Transformers films, I think.
Yeah, massive.
He did Bad Boys before this, which was a good film.
Yes.
He did Armageddon, which was a decent film. His early career, he made some decent films, I have to say. Pearl Harbor, which is a film I've not seen, but people speak highly of.
No.
And then after Pearl Harbor sucks. Took the Transformers.
Pearl Harbor sucks. I mean, we all saw Team America World Police. And the,
no,
as the
I've
song
not
goes,
seen Team America World Police.
Well, there's a song in it called Pearl Harbor Sucks, But I Love You. It's...
And I'm going to seek that film
out. Just seek the song out, because it's Stone and Parker, yeah, at their best. Incidentally, the car chase scene was tacked on right at the end. After they did a lot of the editing of the film, they looked at it and they thought, this is really boring, the first bit. We need an action scene. And so the car chase scene was just completely like done at the end. It's
I can believe that. I can actually believe that. Yeah, it does seem somewhat incongruous, but it's still a great car chase. And yeah, in the great tradition of San Francisco car chases. Yeah, and you've already got it. And I mean, just I'm going to sign off and hand over to Gary at this point, because I believe we might have rinsed this film out. And it's time. I think it's been an hour, and it's time to move on. But as someone who has been to San Francisco too many times, given the distance and cost that it takes there, I adore San Francisco, and I love watching films set in San Francisco. This film goes, you know, in terms of the great pantheon of San Francisco films, there's The Rock, there's Vertigo, and then there is, of course, A View to a Kill. On that, what I will do is I will pass back to Gary, because for two reasons. One, because traditionally Gary closes out these shows. He is, after all, the Odd Job Pod's host. And also because it's his turn to choose the next film for the Action Movie Landfill. Should we be quickly just saying The Rock? Landfill or no landfill? Quickly, James.
Absolutely not landfill. Not at all. This is an action film that has so much more depth than I think even I thought on it. This is... Can I argue that it might even be, you know, Hang It in the Louvre?
Hang It in the Louvre. Graham, Hang It in the Louvre or Tate Modern? What would you reckon?
Yeah, Tate Modern, yeah.
I have no idea what that meant.
Oh, but, no, that's okay.
Never let
it. It's very Michael Bay then, though, isn't it?
It is indeed.
It's a big industrial space, you know, lots of big machinery. Yeah. You know, it's probably got a mine underneath it with lots of little carts in there that you can run around in. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Bankside. Great idea.
A Tate Modern film set in the Rock universe is a film that I would want to see. And I mean, I'm here, you know, sign my petition, listeners. Join my Kickstarter.
There is a theory. There is a theory that that Armageddon and The Rock are set in the same universe because the same guy plays the president in both.
Nice. Nice. Yeah, I'm a big fan of all of that. And I'm a big fan of the Valverdiverse as well. I thought we maybe one day, whenever we do a Valverdiverse film, which hopefully will be sooner rather than later, we'll get to discuss that. But yeah, I think that there was a wasted opportunity of a Rock shared universe. But it's not too late, listeners. It's never too late for this sort of thing. Yeah, no, it definitely not a landfill. This is a film of substance. It's a proper film, and yes, indeed, hang it in your art gallery of choice, or indeed on your shelf if you wish, in a Blu-ray or a 4K DVD. Right then, with that, thank you, gentlemen, for indulging me while I host that. It was a pleasure. I love this film. I love talking about it. But Gary, over to you. What have you chosen as your next action movie landfill for our podcast?
So, interestingly, we've touched on a lot of these themes within here, and I'm going to stay within the 90s. And I'm also going to keep it, I've threatened this a few times, I've teed this up when it's been going to be my choice. So this is one of my mum's favourite action films. She has a very, very high opinion of it. And I've also found that it's also one of my wife's favourite action films as well. Now, I have a feeling it may be because one of the characters, the actors within there. But when we talk about Mad Generals, I think we've had to go into this has exactly what you'd want with Mad Generals. It has a slightly auteurish director into here, and it has a cracking cast as well. You have John Travolta and Christian Slater in Broken Arrow. John Woo's Broken Arrow.
Wow. Oh, that's
into the Wooniverse we go.
Into the Wooniverse. If we have restraint with Ed Harris, we have none of that with Travolta coming up at all. But yes, I have a feeling that the reason that it is so beloved is probably because of Christian Slater, for both my wife and my mother. I think they both a big fan of Christian Slater. But yes, they both said it's a they enjoyed a lot, and you know, it's been a while since I've watched it, and I felt that this would be a perfect landfill discussion film for everybody. Could have gone with Face Off. It was interesting Graham mentioned earlier, because that was Woo's next film behind. No, let's go with Broken Arrow, because I feel it's the lesser scene of the Wooniverse, and potentially deserves its time in the sun. How are you feeling about that choice?
I have seen Broken Arrow once, not long after it came out. So, I mean, I'm stoked. I'm stoked to be able to watch it. Even better still, it's on Disney Plus, and I have a subscription to that. So.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've seen it. I saw it at the cinema. I'm not sure if I've seen it since. Maybe you've seen it once, but yeah, it's. I know. I'm looking forward to getting hold of that one, and yeah. Oh yeah, looking forward to that one already.
Do not expect restraint. Is all I can say within that. There is no restraint here whatsoever. But yes, well, Terry, thank you for taking us through Michael Bay's Rock into there, and I think that was fun. I feel that this is a podcast that's been long overdue, especially given the Bond connotations. I think it was inevitable that this podcast would have been made at some point. So yeah, Terry, thank you for your wonderful job hosting.
Thank you, Gary.
Graham. Thank you as well. And yes, thank you, listeners. We will be back with more Odd Job Pod, and we'll be back discussing Broken Arrow as well. But yes, until that time, take care. And, you know, I feel that we might play out with a bit of Rocket Man flying across flying across San Francisco Bay, which is probably my favourite line from The Rock, and it's just pure ridiculousness in there, and that's why we love action films. So hopefully you've enjoyed it as well. If you haven't seen The Rock, do go and watch it. You will not regret spending a couple of hours with Cage, Connery and The Rock. Not that Rock. Yeah, that Rock's still pretty good as well. Anyway, until then, I'll say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.